I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Naif al-Mutawa, founder of The 99, a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. The series includes comic books, a theme park in Kuwait, and a TV series. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models. The goal is to improve people's self-perception by using archetypes from Islamic culture and to have the messages resonate internationally. Welcome.
Thank you.
Prior to starting The 99, you were a clinical psychologist working at Bellevue with victims of political torture. How did your interest in political torture develop?
I didn't choose it. It kind of chose me. I graduated college and went back to Kuwait, where Saddam's army had just pulled out a couple years before, and so there are a lot of people who had gone through traumatic stress, and so part of my training there as a young psychologist was with those problems. And that led me to get into a graduate program that focused on that, and then when I applied for externships as part of my program, I became more of an asset to a place that had those kinds of clients.
When you were dealing with victims of political torture in Bellevue in the United States, where were they coming from?
So because I speak Arabic, my patients came out of Arab prisons. But there are people there from all over the world, just that I didn't speak the other languages.
You also have an MBA from Columbia Business School. How come you chose to get an MBA and to enter the business world, given that you have a background in clinical psychology?
I caught the bug. I caught the dot-com bug in 2000. And with a couple of friends, raised money and moved to Bahrain and started a company there. And then it was pretty obvious that I didn't have the skills required. And so it was time for me to kind of think about what to do with my life and applied to business school. And one of the best decisions I think I've made.
What other ideas were you flirting with after you graduated from business school if you hadn't started The 99?
Actually, that's a good question. I'll tell you exactly what it was. In business school, I developed a concept called Sayyidina, which is what the name of it eventually was. What it was is when my wife had our first child, in Kuwait, the women take these herbs. And so I went to get her these herbs from the guy who sells the herbs. And the guy had a cigarette between his fingers. And as he was spooning the herbs into a plastic bag, it was like, one part herb, two part cigarette ash, And I was like, I told her, I was like, you're not taking this. And of course, I lost that argument. But then I thought, if this was a branded product, would I have an issue? And so that's what I developed in business school, this idea of getting to the Islamic nutraceutical market. And what happened then is when the U.S. invaded Iraq, my business plan no longer became viable because the problem is that in the GCC, in the Gulf states, you can't just be kind of a marketing company that creates your product at somebody else's plant and white labels it. You actually have to have your plant there for them to come inspect. And the idea of raising money to create something in Kuwait during a war didn't make sense. And so that idea I didn't develop, but I'd already done all the research for, the quote-unquote Islamic market. And so when the idea of the 99 hit, I already had a business plan that I could kind of reform a little bit.
So the business plan for the 99 stemmed from your business plan for this nutraceutical company.
Yeah, go figure.
So how did the idea for the 99 originate?
I literally, 2 weeks out of business school, I was in London in a cab with my mother and my sister, and we were traveling from Edgware Road to Harrods. I like to say it's a pilgrimage every Kuwaiti must make once a lifetime. And
Harrods being the fancy department store.
Exactly. And on the way to Harrods, my sister, had wanted me to go back to writing. I had the stint in the mid-90s where I wrote and illustrated my own books that I intended for adults but got an award for children's literature. And I never intended to write for kids, but that's how I was labeled. And so my sister wanted me to go back doing that. And I wanted her to shut up, but I couldn't do that. My mom's there. And so I just said, somehow for me to go back now, it's got to be something that one day could have the potential of Pokemon. With all these degrees, it doesn't make sense to go back to writing for kids. And so she shut up, and I started to free associate. I said Pokemon. My next thought was there had been a fatwa issued against Pokemon. It's not allowed in some countries back home. My next thought was, my God, what has happened to Islam, and who's making these random decisions for my children? My next thought was, was Allah and how disappointed he must be. My next thought was that Allah had 99 attributes. And ironically, it brought me full circle back to Pokemon, which is a concept of a few hundred attributes. Actually, now it's over 1,000 attributes. And I got out of the cab at Harrods, and I couldn't get out of my mind. It hit me. I didn't know it was going to be superheroes. I didn't know it was going to be comic. I didn't know any of that. But I knew this was the concept. This was going to be the way to reclaim kind of what Islam has become to mean.
you mentioned shut up a few times to your sister. What kind of relationship do you have with your sister?
I have a great relationship with her, which is why I couldn't say shut up. I had to be nice about it. Yeah.
Okay. So you have this eureka moment to create this superheroes series in an effort to reframe Islam for Muslims. Why is there this negative view of Islam among Muslims? When did that develop? Because when Islam was first founded, it was taught in a more positive light. So when did this shift happen?
I mean, I every religion goes through this. You know, if you know, 1400 in the 1400s, you know, Catholics were pouring hot lead down the throats of Muslims and Jews to get them to convert. So, I think you know they say power corrupts and absolute power you know corrupts absolutely, and in the wrong hands, even a piece of paper can be dangerous. So I don't think it's you know something that is necessarily a part of Islam, but that's today that's you know the most poignant example of the negative views of the messaging, and it just so happens that this stuff is happening at a time in which technology is so advanced that you know when there's a suicide thing going on, you can take out dozens, if not hundreds, of people versus the one or two people you could take out in the 1400s.
So your sense is that this conflict within the religion is a natural course of evolution. It happens in every religion.
I believe so, and I think it was arts and culture that took down you know the fundamentalism of the Catholic Church back during the Renaissance. And you know when all of a sudden you could have different opinions of the same thing. And see, the thing is, when you think about kind of arts and culture in the Islamic world, you're talking about 1,000 years where the only representation of art was calligraphy. It was actually the writings from the Holy Book. And so you know, I had ran a little experiment with one of my sons, and I showed him a picture of the Mona Lisa on the internet, and I said, "What do you think of this?" And he said, "I like it, but I don't like the colors. You don't like the smile." And then I showed him a piece of art up on our wall, which is literally a piece of the Quran. And I said, "What do you think of this piece of art?" And he just didn't say anything. And I said, "What's wrong? You gave me the opinion on the Mona Lisa. Why don't you give me the opinion on this?" He said, "It's the Quran. Of course it's beautiful." But you see, the point I'm trying to make is that even the expression and interpretation and opinion about art was held by religion. What are you going to say? The font is too small? I don't like the color purple? There's very finite in terms of the views you can express towards the art.
Out of fear?
Well, because, yeah, I mean, what are people going to think? This is really me, you know, so...
You're afraid to really express your opinion.
Yeah, yeah. I believe strongly that God doesn't need a middleman. And that, you know, the idea of letting a small group of people kind of control the message is the problem that we have today in the Muslim world.
What is the way out of this? The 99 is an effort to improve people's self-perception by using archetypes from Islamic culture. Do you see art and entertainment as that vehicle?
Absolutely. I think I'm somebody who believes that you know the show 24 is one of the reasons we have President Obama in power. I mean, if you think about it, we had five seasons, two with, you know, bad and corrupted white presidents, two with very positive African-American presidents. And actually, I had the opportunity to ask one of the producers at the Library of Alexandria in a panel. I said, you know, I believe you put President Obama in power. And I think you could have also made the kind of a very major impact on getting the first female president. But she, in the end, she did the wrong thing. You know, and then he wouldn't comment on that.
Have been Hillary Clinton.
Could have been, but I really think that art, you know, that's the only way to kind of get a mass media message. I mean, think about what the Cosby Show did for African Americans in the U.S. It's aspirational in the sense that you send a message to the population it's intended for, saying this is what you could become like. But it's also aspirational for people who are not part of the population to kind of try to normalize and mainstream elements that they wouldn't otherwise want to normalize.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, the founder of the comic series, The 99. The series includes comic books, a theme park in Kuwait, and a TV series. The 99 is based on Allah's 99 attributes described in the Quran, and the goal of the series is to provide youth in the Arab world with peacemaking role models. Naif is a psychologist who founded the comic series in 2003. Even though you grew up in Kuwait, you spent a good deal of time in the United States. In addition to college at Tufts and graduate school, you went to camp in New Hampshire. How did you end up in camp in New Hampshire?
You know, it's actually, ironically, it's a Jewish summer camp. It's probably Jewish. And my parents didn't know, and I never told them. I didn't actually realize it until my seventh year there. I went for 10. And the biggest hint should have been that I was the only one that kept kosher.
In your family?
In the camp. But my kids actually now go to that camp.
What's it called?
Camp Robin Hood. It's in Freedom, New Hampshire. But you know, I chose it out of a book on camps. It was the summer of 79, and you know, Mrs. Poole, my second grade teacher, had this book of camps, and my parents wanted me to improve my English, and I liked Robin Hood, and I just chose Robin Hood. And
What did your parents do?
My dad's an investor, and my mom is a philosophy teacher.
And they were fine with your going to the United States for camp?
They chose it. They sent me. My mom actually didn't see it until like the 90s. I got there for 10 years. She had no idea where I was going.
That's funny. You didn't realize that most of the campers were Jewish until your seventh year. When did that strike you?
It was back during the oil tanker crisis in the Gulf in 87, and there were, we're teenagers and people expressing political opinions for the first time, and I kind of realized I was outnumbered in my opinion. But the thing is that I never felt out of place there. I was treated with such respect and dignity and really a very important part of my life.
What about religion in your life? You are Muslim.
I am.
How religious are you, and how religious were you growing up?
Growing up, I wasn't very religious. In fact, Islam was taught to me in very black and white terms, and I don't do black and white. When I went to college, I was kind of like, this is it. I'm done pretending.
Meaning I'm done with the religion?
Yeah, I'm done. I'm done. I'm not going to defend it. I'm not going to be a part of this. My head got turned to the very, very simple thing that happened. There's an imam who actually was doing his PhD at the Harvard Divinity School who came and spoke at Tufts. And he said this. He said, if you asked me if usury or taking interest was against religion, I'd tell you yes, and I'll quote you chapter and verse from the Quran. Then he said, but if I hadn't taken a loan and paid interest on it to buy my car, I couldn't be here today to talk to you about Islam. And that was kind of a big moment for me because he showed me there was a gray area. And I was 19 years old, and I was like, okay, I can do this, I can do. And, so you ask me, am I an observant? In my mind, I am. But to others, I'm not. Mm-hmm. So it just depends on kind of what yardstick you want to use.
So your sense was, if this imam can compromise and not have such a strict interpretation of the Quran, so can I and still be Muslim.
Exactly.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, creator of The 99, a comic series. We'll hear more from Naif coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, founder of The 99, a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models. Your mother tongue is Arabic.
Yes.
But you preferred to read in English.
Yes.
When you were a child. Why is that?
I used to think it was because I didn't like reading in Arabic. And then when I was 26, I came home and had a copy of a book called Cities of Salt, written by an Arab named Abdurrahman Munif. And my mom saw the book in my hand and said, "You're Arab, he's Arab. How dare you put an English translator between the two of you?" Then she made me read it in English and sorry, in Arabic. And then I started getting into more Arabic books, and I realized that the Arabic books I was really getting into weren't really allowed in Kuwait and Saudi and the Gulf. They were all banned. And so I started thinking, huh. It's not because I didn't want to read the stuff in Arabic, because the stuff that could have captured my interest wasn't available to me. So I bought those books in Beirut and Cairo and London and New York.
So it wasn't because you were resisting your culture in any way. It was just that those materials were not available to you.
I think my culture was resisting me in a sense, because one of the things I believe is that in the name of preserving culture, these censors are killing it. They're killing it because people who can actually make a contribution to the culture in the mother tongue are gravitating towards other languages because of lack of stuff that can actually interest them. So, for example, if I had grown up reading in Arabic, I would be writing in Arabic today.
But you didn't grow up reading in Arabic because the authorities are precluding some of these books from getting into the mainstream.
Yeah. So I can write in Arabic, but I can't write the way I write in English.
Why are the authorities such inhibiting forces? What messages do these books have, such as your book's Cities of Salt, that scares the authorities?
That book, I couldn't figure out what it was, why exactly. But it's, you know, it'll be weird stuff. Like, you know, the give you an example. Virgin Megastore got closed down in Kuwait for 3 weeks because of a paragraph in one of the books.
The 99 is a comic series with superheroes inspired by the Quran. But before we get to the 99, I want to talk about Western comics for a moment.
Sure.
What is the origin of Batman and Superman and Spider-Man?
Western comics pretty much follow a biblical archetype. You know, if you look at the superheroes like Batman and Superman and Spider-Man, all of them, like the prophets, are missing parents. And all of them, like the prophets, have a message delivered from above through a messenger. The prophets get it from God through Gabriel. But Peter Parker is sitting there in a library in Manhattan when the spider descends from above and gives him his message through a bite. It's a metaphor for Gabriel coming down with a message. Bruce Wayne is sitting in his bedroom when a bat flies over his head. Superman is not only sent from another planet or from the heavens, but he's sent in a pod very much like Moses was on the Nile to new parents. And you hear the voice of Jor-El, his father, saying to Earth, "I have sent to you my only son."
And how do they compare to your superheroes?
So our superheroes are based on archetypes from the Quran. So, for example, you know, our main bad guy in the 99 is Rugal. Why Rugal? Because Abu Rugal, or father of Rugal, is the person that gave the king of Ethiopia directions to the Kaaba to destroy it back in what's called the Year of the Elephant, which is the year the Prophet, peace be upon him, was born. And according to the Quran, God sent birds with stones that stopped those elephants in their tracks. So if you go back to the 99, for example, you have Rugal, who's intent on destroying what I feel is Islam. He's anti-modernization. He wants to control very fascist agenda. That's our main bad guy. And the 99 stop him, right? They're not birds, but they're superheroes. You know, the Bible is known as the greatest story ever told. The Quran is a pretty good story itself as well. It's been around for not as long, but, you know, 600 years less, but it's been around for a while. And so there are story elements in there that can be captured for positive storytelling that's more modern.
So you said, okay, I'm gonna start this company. What were the next steps? Where did you get the financing?
So I raised $7 million in my first round. $1 million came from my classmates in business school. And those investors are from the U.S., Mexico, China, Lebanon, Jordan. And half the money came from people who had invested in my foray in 2000.
In the dot-com company, which was an Ameritrade partner, an online trading company.
Yes.
Where did you go from there?
At the beginning, I struggled. Then I raised the money. Then I was like, oh, my God, now I feel like a charlatan. I have this money. I mean, I've never done this before. And I really kind of had a lot of self-doubt. And what I did is I hired some people who were part of Marvel when Marvel went public. I had somebody who was the head of marketing, somebody who was the publisher at the time, working with us out of New York. I had a tough time trying to kind of convince U.S. talent 2 years after 9/11 to get involved in this concept. And the way it was ultimately solved is we bought Cracked magazine. I remember Cracked growing up. It was Matt's competitor, Mad magazine. But that was the way in which I was introduced to a lot of talent that wouldn't work with me otherwise.
Was through the acquisition of this magazine.
Yeah.
A comic magazine.
Yes.
You have 5 children, and at the time that you launched the 99, you were married and had children. How were you able to support your family?
Good question. I have 5 sons.
Okay.
At the time, I had 3, and none of them were in school yet. So things weren't as demanding. And plus, I was on a scholarship to do my doctorate. And so I was getting paid by Kuwait. I had income, and I hadn't wrapped up the dissertation yet because my dissertation was on PTSD and
post-traumatic stress disorder.
And my subjects were part of the Kuwaiti military who I couldn't access anymore, and so I was able to kind of continue receiving my funding because it wasn't my fault, and so I was able to kind of make it work.
You were living in Kuwait when you started.
Yes.
Was your wife working at the time?
My wife doesn't work.
Was she supportive of the endeavor?
Yeah, she was. Thank God she was, because I couldn't do it without her. She's, you know, my confidant. Like, I, you know, because being an entrepreneur, there's a lot of ups and downs. And it's, you know, manic depression on steroids. Funding's supposed to come this month, doesn't come for a couple months. So, you know, she's able to kind of calm me and absorb me and be very, very supportive. I mean, I really could not do this without her.
How has the 99 been received by the Muslim world, or at least initially?
Initially, what I was prepared for is exactly what happened. You know, when you introduce a foreign body or a new body into your bloodstream, what happens? The white blood cells come out and fight. It doesn't matter if it's good for you, bad for you. It's different. It has to, you know, we have to kill it. And the same thing happens in the mind. When a new thought gets introduced, you know, people will kind of try to bury it. And so I had some resistance in the beginning. But I was prepared for it psychologically. And was able to kind of maneuver my way around it to the point in which, when we did our financing the second round, we did it through an Islamic investment bank, and that kind of quieted down the criticism, but didn't affect our content. At the end of the day, I mean, our content has nobody's religion in it. It's like seeing the kosher sign on the jar or the food. It doesn't mean that, you know, non-Jews can't eat it, but it means the Jews can eat it too. And so that was the idea of kind of getting this bank behind us. It doesn't mean that this is just for Muslims, but it means that Muslims can watch this too. And it kind of it helped deal with the pushback.
Because they felt they were a part of it now.
Yeah.
What are some examples of the worst moments you've had in this process?
Between the first and second round of financing, the money was supposed to come in March. We were running out of cash around then. And management stopped taking their salaries. And then that wasn't enough. And so I took out a personal loan because I couldn't let the new investors know we were in that situation, because they smell blood in the water. All of a sudden, you know, either they pull out or they try to renegotiate your valuation, right? So it was very tough.
How long did that last?
3 months. 3 months. And then we closed. And then, I got back the money I lent the company and was able to close out that loan. And obviously, I paid the interest personally. But I kept a straight face and I let my board know afterwards that I had done this. And it's one of those things where it's always better to ask for forgiveness than for permission. Another one is, you know, when we got stopped in Saudi, and that was really dependent on, our business model was really dependent on it. And so that was kind of like, oh, my God, now what?
Why were you stopped in Saudi?
Our distributor was zealous. He was very excited about the project. So when he submitted the paperwork to the ministry there, he wrote between brackets, God's 99 names. And all of a sudden we're in a situation where they're trying to find where the subversive messaging was to do with religion. Of course, it's not there. We got put in a hole unfairly that we couldn't get out of for a while until we, you know, got that funding from the Islamic Bank.
Did they ultimately retract that?
Ultimately, it was weird. What was weird is that they allowed it in English and they allowed some of the issues in Arabic. Pretty soon, ultimately, there won't be any stopping it because it'll be on TV, it'll be on the internet. It's, you know, it will be there. It'll be seen. And the irony is that the biggest support I've had is from Saudi. Most, you know, more than half of my investors are related to Saudi in one way or another. My wife is Saudi. You know, my kids speak to me in Saudi dialects I don't understand sometimes. So, yeah.
What were some turning points for you with the 99 that helped it get recognition?
In terms of recognition, there's been two really important ones. One was I cornered a New York Times journalist back in December 2005 in Dubai at the Arab Thought Foundation, and I pitched him, even though I had no product yet. And he, you know, he interviewed me, and then he told me, you know, we'll release this article about you. But, you know, I was excited. You know, when he said, well, you know, it's Islam and cartoon is not a timely topic, so, you know, next week, next month, eventually. And what happened is a month later, I called him up. I said, Happy New Year. He said, thanks. We had a baby. I said, congratulations. You know, when's the article coming out? He said, oh, it's not timely. And a couple of days after that, the world erupts in the Danish cartoon controversy. And I became timely. And just luck. And, you know, a flurry of emails and phone calls to the New York Times. Next thing you know, it's a full page on January 22nd, 2006. And anybody Googling Islam and cartoon or Islam and comic trying to figure out what's going on in the world with the Danish cartoon controversy got me. And then the most recent is President Barack Obama's mentioning of the 99 and the crossover, which, you know, when I had the idea for the crossover, it was back in February 2009. I was having lunch with Paul Levitz, who was then the president of DC Comics. And so I went to him, I said, you know, Marvel pulled this quick, cheap shot that nobody saw coming on Inauguration Day, because they had President Obama with Spider-Man on the cover of one of their magazines, and it became a big seller, and because President Obama likes comics. I said, good for them, but you have the ability now and to fulfill President Obama's vision. And I pitched him a crossover between the 99 and the Justice League.
What's the Justice League?
The Justice League is Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Aquaman. They're called the Justice League of America, collectively. And so he loved it. We negotiated a deal. And then 2 weeks after the president spoke from Cairo, on July 2nd, DC Comics announced this crossover. And then the first book came out October 27th, 2010. And President Obama spoke about it in his speech. He called it the most innovative response to his Cairo speech because he reached out to the Muslim world, and in return, the 99 reached right back out to the Justice League, to their American counterparts.
Through comic superheroes.
Through comic superheroes, yeah.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Naif Al-Mutawa, creator of The 99, a comic series that incorporates teachings from Islam. The superheroes in The 99 were created with the intention of providing youth in the Muslim world with positive role models, and the goal is to reframe Islam for Muslims. You also helped to launch the region's largest private mental health clinic based in Kuwait. When did you do that?
I went to one of my mentors in 2008, Dr. Jafar Babahani, somebody who for 25 years had been practicing psychology in Kuwait, not taking a dime from anybody because he could afford to, but also because he cared. And for the 15 years I knew him, he was trying to change the laws in Kuwait, because in Kuwait, it's not the Ministry of Health that regulates you as a psychologist, it's the Ministry of Commerce. And so people who have a degree will go open up a bodega and start seeing clients, and lots of quacks in the market. And, you know, I went to him and I said, Jafar, you know, I can help you change psychology in Kuwait, but it's going to be through a social business. It's not going to be through the governments. And the model I gave him was that of the Sultan Center in Kuwait. So the Sultan Center is like the most successful supermarket chain in Kuwait. And before they came into being, there were all these supermarkets that are, you know, owned by the government that were terrible. The shoes were being sold next to the apples, next to the shampoo, and it was just abysmal. But Sultan Center said, you know, they basically set up the nicest supermarket in Kuwait and forced all the other supermarkets to change or go out of business. And I said, that's the model I want to use. I want to set up the nicest clinic in Kuwait, have the best talent, and then you force these guys to go out of business. And that's exactly what happened.
You helped to launch this private mental health care clinic while you were working intensely on getting the 99 off the ground. What is the connective tissue between the two?
The only connective tissue for me was that it was an investment, and that they say if something can go wrong, it will go wrong. I got blindsided. My mentor passed away in the middle of the setup of it, and I found myself in the middle of another startup on my own, and it was one of the worst years of my life in terms of the amount of work. Obviously what had to give was not as much time with my family that year, and. But it's up and running, and it's, you know. In hindsight, it was probably not the smartest thing to do. Being an investor in something is fine. Being the investor in something when you're running something else, not very smart.
You wrote children's books in the 1990s.
Yes.
How did you develop an interest in writing?
I've always wanted to be a writer. I mean, I told my parents when I was 9 or 10 that I was going to be a writer when I grew up, and they said that's a great hobby. You know, don't think about doing it for work. You know, back when I did these children's books, it was in response to somebody who had been fired because of their religion in Kuwait, and the guy that fired him gave out leaflets to the local community apologizing that had he known the guy's religion, he wouldn't have hired him to begin with.
What was the guy's religion?
I think he was Sikh, and so I was wondering what planet I just landed on after college, and I wrote and illustrated this book that I intended for adults. it was about what's going on in Rwanda and Yugoslavia at the time and this guy, but UNESCO recognized it with an award for kids literature. And I was like, oh my God, thank you, but kids. This wasn't meant for kids. But that led to a proper 3-book contract because that book was self-published. I tried to find publishers in the region, and all of them were kind of, you know, they pay you $1,000 and keep the IP. But I didn't want to do that. And so I actually sold a real estate ad in this book, and that's how I got the financing and learned the business. So I wrote it, I illustrated it, I was involved in packaging it and distributing it, and I put like these little moving kiosks in different malls that my family were friends with the owners of the mall. So I'd stand there selling my book, kind of thing, and it was an interesting experience. And did that. Book one did well. Book two got well. Book two did well. Book three got stopped. Book four got stopped.
Because?
Because the ideas were threatening.
Because they were about religious toleration?
I never mentioned religion in the books. So in the first book, basically, it's about a land called Bouncy Land where everybody's round. In that society, they judge you based on two values, how high you bounce and how fast you roll. The main character is born as a half circle, can't do either, is ostracized, you know, his parents are ashamed. But at the end, there's a flood, and in a flood, if you're around, you can't control yourself. But he's half circle, so he's a boat, so he's able to save them one by one, and forces society to reevaluate the importance of diversity.
I guess the seeds for children's literature were sown in the 1990s when you were writing these books for children by accident. Yeah. And little did you know that you'd be creating this series for children decades later.
I mean, I honestly thought that was my best idea. That was it, the bouncy stuff. But when the 99 hit, I mean, I came back. So I quit writing at 27, came back at 32, I say, armed with my 99 superheroes.
Is there evidence, at least anecdotally, of the impact that the 99 has had on altering the mindset among Muslim youth?
What I can tell you is this. The 99 has made it to all kinds of, you know, whether it's classes in schools. A professor at Tufts in philosophy came up to me. She's a professor from Dartmouth, came to me when I spoke at a Tufts event and said, you know, that she had just been at the University of Heidelberg where she had presented a paper on Kant and other people presented papers on other philosophers, you know, Nietzsche and Kierkegaard, but the opening paper was about the thinking behind the 99. In terms of kind of making a small dent in you know, academic circles and therefore into kind of classes, you know, we certainly have seen the beginnings of that. But one of my favorite photographs, which I have on my computer, it's a madrasa out in South Asia where you have this guy with his long beard and these little girls wearing the hijab all holding up copies of the 99 smiling, and the picture was sent to me. And that's the good news. The bad news is there were photocopies, so we didn't make any revenue on those. But it's getting there. It's getting there. Even if there's a chance to kind of gather evidence, I don't know how you do that. I mean, I just do kind of my part. And, the irony is I started off this company trying to get into the magic pill business, and hopefully we created a magic pill of sorts.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Naif Al-Muhtawa, creator of the 99. Coming up, we'll meet the inventor Maurice Kanbar. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is the inventor Maurice Kanbar. His creations include the DeFuzzit sweater comb, which removes lint from sweaters, the Safety Glide hypodermic needle protector, an LED traffic light, and Sky Vodka, which he launched in 1993. Maurice also founded the Quad Cinemas in 1972, the first multiplex theater in New York City. And in 1997, he donated $5 million to NYU, creating the Maurice Kanbar Institute for Film and Television. Welcome.
Nice to be here.
You grew up in Brooklyn, New York.
Yes.
What type of household did you grow up in?
It was a simple household, a mother, father, two brothers, and we certainly weren't rich, but of course I never went hungry. We had a 3-year-old Chevrolet in the driveway of a little house that we had, and, my father worked hard. My mother was basically a housewife who cooked meals for us, and my first job was working as a delivery boy for a drugstore because I was small and slight and couldn't afford to carry the big packages at the AMP. And I can tell you this, that my bicycle was never locked and it was never stolen. It was a different world.
Now, you went to a yeshiva school in Brooklyn.
I did go. My parents sent me there because they thought I would get a good education, which, of course, they were right, even though they were not orthodox. I didn't like it at the time because we had to go at 8:30 in the morning till 4:30, and the other kids were going from 9 to 3. Anyway, that's what happened there.
You've created more than 100 different objects or products, not all of which have gone to market, but at what point did you think, you know, I want to make a professional life out of making things?
Well, actually, I never really thought I would make a professional life out of it. I was very fortunate. I tell a story about my first real invention that made a lot of money, and I was wearing a sweater. My back was against a concrete wall, and then my college roommate pulled me away, and I turned and I felt something grab on my sweater, and I looked at the wall, and sure enough, there were three fuzz balls on the concrete. Anyway, I realized that it was the sand in the concrete, which is crystalline in nature, and these little crystals grabbed the fuzz balls and took it off, actually. I said, that's great. Anyway, to make a long story short, I bought some coarse fabric. I put some adhesive on it, and I sprinkled it with a sandpaper, a sand like sandpaper. Let it dry, and lo and behold, it worked beautifully in removing fuzz balls from sweaters. It also opened up a lot of the fuzz balls. Mm. So it's much better than shaving them off.
Now, this became the Defuzz It Sweater Comb.
The Defuzz It Sweater Comb.
Was this your first patent?
That was my first patent and my first moneymaker, and it was very successful.
How did you go about selling it?
Well, I didn't have much money at the time, and a friend of mine had just lost his job, so I brought Malcolm into the picture. We went to the library. This was before Google, you know. We went to the library and got the names of sweater departments in large department stores and all the Notions. In those days, there were a lot of Notions department that sold sewing and stuff like that and sold wool. So we made a package. A little brown envelope that I bought, and I put two defuzzed combs and a little note that we had printed by a local printer. And we said, please use the defuzzed. And if you like it as we do, you can order three dozen, 6 dozen, 12 dozen. Here the prices, blah, blah. And we got orders. In the first 12 months, if I remember correctly, we made $220,000, which in those days is the equivalent of $2 million today.
You grew up in New York City, and now you live in San Francisco, where you have a 10,000 square foot warehouse, essentially, which is the home of most of your creations. Before you moved to San Francisco, you also dabbled in the film world. You developed, almost by accident, the first multiplex in New York City.
I believe it was the first multiplex, certainly on the East Coast. Mm. I don't know of any other multiplex.
How did you come to create this multiplex? And it's called the Quad Cinemas.
I love movies, okay? And so I go to the movies, and we're having dinner, and somebody was complaining who owned some theaters in Chicago was complaining they were losing money. People don't go to the movies. They all watch television. And this was 1972, and it really affected the movie business. And here I was in a 1,500-seat house, and I counted the house. There were 120 people. So I said to myself, I could build 450-seat houses in this location that I have, and if 100 people show up for each film, I'm doing fine. Mm-hmm. So to make a long story short, I built the theaters, and we were profitable the first month.
How did you come to own the building?
Well, a friend of mine who wanted to build a off-Broadway theater in this building, he said to me, would you please buy this building? I will rent it. So I said, okay. I said, and I love theater. So I said, fine. So I bought the building, and it turns out he couldn't raise the money. So all of a sudden, I owned the building. He said, I'm so sorry. I said, God, what am I going to do with this building now, you know? And then I said, you know, let's build four little movie houses.
Now, this was in 1972. Where did you get the capital at this point to buy, you know, this building in New York City, for example? Which of your inventions created the most income for you?
Well, the defuzzet was making money, and I had one job in my life. It was selling DuPont fibers, and I got the idea that I can compete with DuPont in one little category, and which I finally did with great difficulty to raise the money. And 14 months after I set the plant to make nylon yarn, we sold it to then the largest hosiery company called Kaiser Roth. I didn't rush out and buy custom-made suits. I mean, I'm basically frugal. And then actually the Bankers Trust at that time lent me some money plus my own, and I was able to build it.
Now, you mentioned that you're frugal. You still clip coupons, and you drive around San Francisco on a scooter. To what extent is this part of this, depression mentality that you grew up in,
well,
the
1930s? I don't think it's so much a depression because I didn't suffer. I mean, you know, people standing online to get a bowl of soup, but I never had that problem. Let me say this. I don't like waste. It's part of the way you're brought up. You were brought up to be philanthropic. If you have more on your plate than you can eat, find someone who's hungry, you know?
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the inventor, Maurice Kambar. Some of his creations include the Safety Glide Hypodermic Needle Protector, a device for removing varicose veins, and Sky Vodka, which was sold to Campari International for over $400 million. The Safety Glide Hypodermic Needle Protector, what was the catalyst for that invention?
Well, I have a friend of mine who's a physician, and he told me that, this is about 10 years ago, he said, you know, last year there were 20,000 accidental needle sticks. And he said, you know, we have to invent something to protect these hospital workers and physicians from accidentally sticking themselves. And then flying to New York one day from San Francisco, I was looking out the window, and I said, wow, I got it. And I made it, made the model, it worked. And rather than, I'm not going to go into the hypodermic business, we licensed Becton Dickinson, the largest manufacturer of syringes in the world. And we've been making very substantial royalties. And my doctor friend gets a portion of that because he kept pushing me. And it's been terrific.
Your inventions are industry agnostic, you know, ranging from healthcare to alcohol to vodka. Yeah. And Sky, which you founded in 1993, has claimed to not cause hangovers because you remove the impurities called congeners in the distillation process. Could you explain that?
Well, when you ferment any carbohydrate, you get alcohol plus some ingredients that are naturally formed impurities that are called congeners. Now, these impurities are what gives the particular alcohol, like bourbon or cognac, its flavor. Now, in order to remove them, you have to distill at a very precise temperature to distill off the amyl alcohol, then another temperature to distill off the propyl alcohol. And you can do that and therefore purify the alcohol.
And at once these congeners are removed, does the alcohol then become tasteless?
It becomes odorless and tasteless. That is correct. As a matter of fact, if I took cognac and distilled the congeners out, I would have vodka. These congeners impart a very interesting taste, okay? But for me, they imparted a headache. So I said, let's get those things out of there. I had a big problem getting distilleries to do 4 distillations. And they all thought I was a little crazy because they said, look, we've been making alcohol for 140 years. Nobody has asked us to distill 4 times. I said, well, I'm asking you to do that. And it's a long story. They finally found somebody who would do it.
So here you are. You finally convinced a distiller to make this odorless alcohol without these impurities so that you wouldn't get a hangover. Then what?
The first hurdle that you have basically in any product that you'd like to sell is what are you going to call it? So my first name was, let's call it Prince Romanov Vodka. I'll have a Prince Romanov on the rocks. Didn't sound right. Well, how about Tsar Nikolai? That didn't sound right. I said, it's not going to be Russian. It will be made in this good old USA. So, Maurice, think about some other name. Okay. And a few months went by. I couldn't think of a name. One day I looked out my window, and there was a magnificent blue sky. And I said, oh, look at that. I said, that's the name Sky Vodka. I called up my patent attorney and told him to register the name. He said, how are you spelling it? I said, S-K-Y. He said, that's no good. I said, that's like air or water. Oh, I said, oh, God, it was a great name. And then to make a long story short, that was fortunate, added the other Y and gave it a distinct look and a great call, because a person walks in by and says, I have a Sky on the rocks, or give me a Sky Martini, give me a Sky Driver. It was a great name.
And incidentally, it's also in this what's become this iconic blue bottle.
Well, it certainly gave it a distinction that no other vodka had, because people say, what's in that blue bottle? Oh, that's Sky Vodka. Oh, let me try that. That was stuff that I created myself. I mean, I didn't have some marketing genius telling me how to do this. I designed the label myself. I designed the bottle myself. I designed the blue glass.
How surprised were you at the success of Sky? At one point, it was one of the leading vodkas sold in the United States.
I was very pleasantly surprised, okay? I said, boy, I never thought it would be this hot or this terrific, because I didn't have the advertising budget and whatnot. I mean, this was done grassroots, and I must tell you that thank God we live in America. As an example, I mean, I wanted to go in the alcohol business. I went to the state, and I said, fill out this form. Have you been convicted of a felony? What is your mother's maiden name? $250. Stamp, you're in business now. Go. Mm-hmm. In Europe, there's no way that they would let me go into the vodka business or any alcohol business, okay?
You mentioned that your efforts were grassroots. What does that mean? What did you do in the early days to get Sky off the ground?
I focused on getting articles written in newspapers about my product. So all of a sudden, we got an enormous amount of free publicity, and it was true.
Also, Sky at one point had other products, had the distribution rights for third-party brands like Cuddy, Sark, Scotch, Whiskey, yeah. Molinet, Molinari, Sambuca, Campari, and Cinsano.
Yes.
To what extent were those, was that distribution agreement, how much did that add to the success of Sky ultimately?
It didn't add much to the value of Sky because those brands did not belong to me. But what happened was I got so big and I said I needed some guys who could help me run this business because I was working from 8 to 6 and this is too much, okay?
You mean 8 a.m. to 6 p.m.?
Right.
And okay. That's a lot?
Every day. Oh, yeah. To me, that's a lot. Well, for an inventor, that's a lot. Anyway, I hired a couple of guys from Diageo, a big, big firm, okay? I said, take it over. And when they came on board, they were able to get one of the brands was Campari. They said, come with us. We will really make sure your item is sold and shown and whatnot. So we got all these guys, small guys who were being sold by a big company. And we made a commission on every bottle that we sold. But the real business was Sky.
What part of your net worth was created by the Sky sale versus all the other products you've ever produced?
Well, it's probably the largest portion of my net worth and probably 80% or... maybe 70%, but the largest portion.
There have been a number of products that you took to market that didn't work out, one of which was this drink called the 80-20 Cola.
Yes.
Which was a reduced-calorie drink.
I made a very big mistake with 80-20 Cola in that. And a young lady took me to lunch and took me to Burger King. What would you like to drink, sir? And I said, I'll have a Diet Coke. Okay. So he gives me the chicken tenders and there's an empty paper cup. I walked over and I said, Carolyn, look at this is America. Got regular Coke, Diet Coke, Sprite, Schmite, Dr. Pepper. We have a choice. It's wonderful. So I said, let me try this. I took about 20% of regular Coke and 80% Diet Coke, and lo and behold, it tasted like all sugar Coke. I said, this should be an item that could sell. And I got the name 80-20 Cola. Now, here's an instance where I did not do my homework. I thought on a six-pack, Coca-Cola makes a dollar. Turns out they make 12 cents. That's no market at all. Two, if we start really selling this at Safeway, we have no patent. Coke and Pepsi will make an 80-20 Cola. I said, this was a big mistake on my part, and I'm giving it up.
Even if they made an 80-20 Cola, your brand might have been enough.
By that time, it would be too late. I couldn't afford the advertising, and they would go to Safeway, and they would get a better position. I failed. I mean, I accept failure.
Incidentally, you talk about the importance of a name. You've developed a dental floss whose patent has run out. But one of the reasons you didn't ultimately try to push it to market is you couldn't come up with a name.
I couldn't come up with a name, right.
What was so special about this dental floss?
And I said, well, it's a film rather than a fiber. And it's a crumbled film that's very strong and has two advantages. One, it slides easily. And two, the fact that it's crinkly that way wipes the tooth better than a fiber. I use it myself, but I have not sold any. Somebody came out with a dental floss called Glide. And I said, if I had had that name, I would have gone in. So again, to me, a name is extremely valuable if you get the right name. It's still on the shelf.
One of your inventions is a Rollo cane, which is a three-wheeled cane to help people walk more smoothly.
I have not given it the time or attention that it deserves, okay? And because I can't find anybody to manage the business and I can't do it, it's on the shelf, ready to go anytime somebody wants to do it. And it's a terrific thing for people who need a cane, but this is an easy cane to roll. My mother used it before she died. But anyway.
What would you say you're most proud of?
Probably the needle protector, because if that saved one life, okay, from getting AIDS, I mean, we have an expression in Judaism, and by the way, it's Judaism, not Judaism, as most people pronounce it. In Judaism, there's, you know, he who saves one life saves the world. We have 3 degrees of charity. I don't know if you know this, but the highest degree is where the recipient does not know the donor, and the donor does not know the recipient. The second degree is where the recipient does not know the donor, but the donor knows the recipient. So the recipient is not always embarrassed every time he meets the donor. And the lowest form is he knows the donor and he knows the recipient. But there are 3 degrees of charity. So, of course, I mean, I feel very proud that, who knows, 1, 2, maybe 10 people did not get AIDS because of this invention, and that makes me very proud.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure to be here.
My guest has been the inventor, Maurice Kambar. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at FromScratchRadio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.